you're listening to the HyberCloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to HyberCloud with your host, Andre Tost.
All right, welcome everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of the HyberCloud Podcast. Before we even get started, a short disclaimer. I'm a bit under the weather now, so my voice probably sounds like I've been partying for several nights, but that's not the case. But I didn't want to lose the opportunity to talk to Shankar today. Thanks a lot for coming, Shankar.
Absolutely, Andre. My pleasure.
Shankar Kalyana is an IBM fellow, and he's also a VP of Global Solutioning in our consulting business. And we'll obviously hear a lot more about what that means and what he really does. But let's start out, like always, with introductions. Maybe if you could tell us a bit about your upbringing, your professional background, what brought you to IBM, and all the way leading to what you're doing for IBM today.
That was actually interesting, Andre, that I did an earlier podcast, I think it was last year, maybe a couple of years ago, on a leadership agenda where I went through, I think there's like a somewhere on YouTube, there's like 2 30-minute segments of my entire career, so to speak, out there. But we definitely will not do that and repeat it here. Let's actually do an extreme Cliff Notes version of it. So I've been with IBM the last, I'm on the 23rd year, I think, something like that. But interestingly, my very, very first computing job 35 years ago back in India was in some sense with IBM and IBM culture, even though it was not called IBM. I actually started with the remnants of IBM when IBM had to leave India back in the 70s. They left behind that entire company, obviously, and it was taken over by the government of India and so on. But the culture and the market and the skills and the technology, all that was IBM. Yeah. So when I joined, that is the culture I grew up in. So in a strange way, I actually started on the mainframe 360 thing right from the get-go and had this nice inflection point evolution of the last 35 years from mainframe to client server to object-oriented to service-oriented to now distributed fully, in the cloud era, right? So I've kind of gone through all these inflection points. So that's one dimension of it. And the other dimension that I always love technology is it's almost like my career has been in, interestingly, 3 distinct arcs. The first was, just go crazy on learning everything about technology, right? My first, several years of computing. And the second, arc when I probably matured as a consultant, thanks to, being at places like Deloitte. And then the third is my current arc of being and growing as a technical leader in IBM. So that's actually been a, really fruitful and longish, career path in terms of going through technology inflection points, going through personal evolution inflection points, and also different industries, different clients, global, just experiences that are just varied, right? So I'm probably thankful to all the multifaceted experiences that I've actually had over this last 3 decades. So,
was that mostly in a consulting role?
Yeah, I would say. We would call them consulting today, I guess, but for all practice, so I was never in the classic product engineering, product development, software development, in research, those kinds of, things. I would say we would translate all everything I've done as systems integration, right, in the larger space, right from my first gig to what we've been doing. And this is the consulting and systems integration space in the services industry, right? Where we've done assets, asset development we have done, we've led products in that regard, we have stood up, capabilities that are actually as a service capabilities in the product level. But obviously we have also, a lot of the career that I've actually done has been across the, what I look at, describe as the 2x2 of systems in general. One is the solution stack of the business application and platform. This is a stack layer, the end-to-end stack. And the other is the end-to-end lifecycle, which we today refer to as day zero, day one, day two, but really the entire DevSecOps lifecycle. So this 2x2 continuum is the space that I've operated in, right? Across the lifecycle, across the stack. Yeah. So in the systems integration, type metaphor, right? So that's what I've actually done.
Okay. And how does that lead to, and maybe you can just explain the term to us, you know, and like I said, your job title is global solutioning. I guess I get the global part of it, but solutioning, what does that really entail?
So if you take the lifecycle thing we just talked about, right, of a client engagement lifecycle. So DevSecOps, in one hand, you know, refers to this ideation to, you know, transformation, continuous, a virtual cycle of continuous transformation. But if you step back and look at the macro view of how that ends up manifesting in from a systems engagement, systems engineering standpoint, of figuring out, understanding an initiative of a client initiative, of an enterprise initiative, or a certain objective that they actually have to achieve, certain business objectives, certain business goals, you know, metrics that they have to, you know, outcome, whether it's around innovation, whether it's around agility, whether it's around cost efficiency, it doesn't matter, right? You know, all these objectives. Those eventually lead to a set of initiatives that then have to get conceptualized to some extent in terms of problem definition, as well as figuring out, okay, what is the right approach, architecturally speaking, implementation-wise, realization-wise, technology choices-wise, you name it, right? I mean, how do we really put this together to be able to do that? And then, you know, once you, and that usually has its own a technical model you have to come up with, a delivery model you have to come up with, and a commercial model you have to come up with to really figure out what is the cost, you know, benefit analysis, you know, what does it really entail in terms of value return and return on investment, et cetera. So all that aspects before we can go execute, right? And then say, hey, let's actually go build this thing and develop the system or upgrade the system, do whatever, which you would normally look at as a classic idea to transformation lifecycle, right? So that entire implementation lifecycle is great. But prior to that is all this thing we just talked about. How do you figure out what the right initiatives are? How do you, you know, problem analyze it? How do you create a solution around it? And how do you estimate it? How do you really ensure that all these models come together such that, you know, you can build a plan that is executable? That entire pre-aspect is technically, you know, what we would call a solutioning, right? So that space of, you know, so it's a mix of selling, consultative selling, architectural thinking, and architectural application of problem solving and conceptualization of a solution. And at the same time, also putting a complex system together and realizing and figuring out what it takes to put a system together. And all that engineering and architectural thinking that goes into it is what we think of as solutioning. And then obviously now it's about iterating to go implement it. Now we go create a blueprint, put a realization together, go through it. So from my perspective, even though on one hand, yes, that solutioning aspect is a lot of what I do, I also get engaged in the full life cycle of actual implementation and ensure that whatever we conceptualize, hey, we said you're going to, it is going to take 8 months to do. It's going to cost us, you know, I don't know, $20 million to do it. And by the way, it's going to have a return of XYZ. We need to make sure that that's exactly what happens, right? As you go through the implementation lifecycle. So that entire implementation lifecycle is what we would normally think of as product engineering lifecycle or a product development lifecycle or a software systems development lifecycle. So I kind of play across the space. So technically I do sit in the solutioning organization, but my span of coverage and engagement is through the sales and solutioning and implementation lifecycle.
That sounds like you're getting involved in very early stages, right? So what an example would be, and I'm just making this up, like a customer coming to you and said, I need to improve on the way I do supply chain. And can you help me figure out what a better solution could look like?
Is that a typical example? Yeah, something like that. Something like that. That could be a trigger point, right? So you usually have trigger points that are something as very specific as that. Like here's a domain, here's a specific problem that we have, you know, help us figure out what is the right way to approach it, right? It could be as simple as that. Sometimes it's about a strategic thing, you know, a bit more broader and a bit more looser, right? That says that, you know, we really have a portfolio that requires optimization in general, right? For example, right? That we have real estate, an application real estate of 480 applications that are spending X amount of money, and we are spending 70% of that on maintenance. How do we optimize it so that we can put more money on the front end, right, et cetera? So you can have a different trigger point. You can have trigger points around a complete different new strategy initiative from a business standpoint that ends up in an RFP to go build a complete platform, for example. So your trigger points were different, but they all usually entail this kind of thinking that we just talked about, right? And how do you architecturally and methodically analyze the problem, break it down into chunk parts, figure out the current state, determine target state, figure out a roadmap for execution for it, right, et cetera. So you kind of go through a very, you know, formalized process for analyzing this problem, right? So
So let's spend let's draw the line to hybrid cloud then. Maybe starting with, if you could, and I ask that often, I ask my guests often about their definition of hybrid cloud to begin with. So maybe we can start there. If you could tell us, what's your elevator speech on hybrid cloud?
So let's start with let's not even call it etymology, but if we want to go back to the core thought process behind it, right? So cloud in general, from an origin standpoint, referred to things that are not necessarily owned by you, that didn't live with you, that you can actually leverage infrastructure and platform and services in general that were available anywhere that you could actually rent and or use on a shared, model basis. Okay. I mean, that's kind of the origin story offered. So in that sense, that got equated to this notion of a public cloud, which meant there are data centers that you didn't own, computing capacity and our services that you didn't necessarily own. You didn't have to maintain them. You didn't have to develop them. You just consumed them, right? And they just pay per use their model. So that's the classic definition of cloud. But by definition, that entailed that you didn't own them, which meant they were away from you, right? Which meant, somebody else owned them and you were sharing capacity and so on and so forth. That has a lot of benefits, as we have found out over the years. But it also, brought in a lot of other concerns and other kind of constraints, whether it's around security, whether it's around data, privacy, whether it's around data gravity, and so on and so forth. So this notion of now looking at stepping back and you're looking at, hey, you know what? We have workloads that need to different use cases, different kind of workloads, different kinds of solutions that require different kinds of models. So we had to kind of step back and look at deployment models for our specific kinds of use cases. And the classic things being, hey, you know what? Either I'm completely on-prem, quote unquote, I own it in a dedicated, full model, or I create an instance of the same cloud type model into my on-prem environment and call it a private cloud, which is completely owned by me. Or I can actually go into the public cloud and create a space for me virtually and have a dedicated presence that way, through a VPC or a virtual private cloud type concept, or truly end up in the public cloud model where it's fully shared that everybody has everything, right? So you have this continuum of one end being true on-prem that I own everything, it's all mine, to the other end of the spectrum where it's nothing is owned by me, everything is shared, right? And then in between you have these models. So you can think of it as, hey, either I am choosing one of these or my enterprise strategy requires me to adopt all four of these strategies for different kinds of use cases, different kinds of workloads. So the moment you end up in that kind of a model, now we're talking about a hybrid situation. So that's where the hybrid notion comes into play to say, it's a combination of on-prem to private to, dedicated to public, depending on the type of use case. And that kind of a strategy is typically where we see a lot of enterprises having evolved to. And of course, there's another dimension to it is that cloud is not just cloud. It's also multi in the sense of, I can have a public cloud from a software as a service provider for, CRM type service. I can have a different one, for doing cost analysis and FinOps. So you can have different models and different cloud providers themselves and service providers in this ecosystem. So what we are finding is many enterprises are grappling and having to deal with this model of both hybrid and multi in a very together way. So hybrid cloud has come to mean all of these things today in practically speaking, but really that's the way I think about it.
So it's probably then fair to assume that these things influence all the projects that you're engaged in some form or shape as the backdrop against which you're actually solutioning, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing. If I go back to the evolution point, what we have always done, in fact, if I go back to my 35 years of, working in the space, it's always been about problem solving in this notion of, hey, an enterprise has a problem where technology is an enabler and or the solution, for that. And let's figure out how to do that right. So that's where business systems and commercial systems have always been about how do you apply technology effectively to solve, business needs and business problems and business opportunities, right? That's always been the case. The mechanics for them have actually changed as we've gone through various inflection points. How we did them in the mainframe era, we're still problem solving. It's just that we're doing different techniques to solve them. So in that sense, 15 years ago, service-oriented architecture, was kind of the way a lot of these things came about. In the last 10 years, cloud-oriented computing and cloud-enabled models and cloud-enabled transformation is being underpinning of it. So yeah, completely. I would say at least for the last like eight years, since like 2014, everything that I have actually dealt with has been in the cloud and hybrid cloud space, where every solution that we have been doing is really around that. That's where clients are. That's where enterprises are. That's where the market is. And as a result, you know, pretty much every commercial system usually ends up becoming, you know, this kind of a model, right? Yeah. So yeah, the answer is complete yes.
That leads me to another question. I'm curious about your point of view on that. I started almost saying to ask somebody if they're doing cloud computing is almost the same as if you ask her, are you in IT? It almost becomes implicit. It's almost something you don't need to even mention anymore because cloud has become kind of the state of the art of how you do IT systems, right? At the same time, we see enterprises being kind of as at the early stages of that transformation still, or what would you say is the mix? I mean, the companies that you work with, I mean, what with respect to their maturity, how soon can we stop even mentioning cloud because it's like saying it runs on a computer?
Yeah, it's a great point, Mark and Ray, because I think there is always a difference between hype and reality, right? So the hype side of the equation says that, yeah, cloud is the de facto model. And cloud, by the way, here, the moment I say cloud, I'm implying hybrid cloud in the model we just talked about, right? But with that said, the hype says that's where many enterprises are. The reality dictates that even within an enterprise that has adopted cloud, it is not a homogenous conversation, right? There are certain domains which are a little bit behind than other domains. There's more experimentation going on. There is more immaturity going on. In certain things are much more advanced. I think migration, for example, right? And people have said, let me take workloads that are analog to cloud and actually just lift and shift from the cloud. I think that train has left the station quite a bit. Many enterprises have actually done that, are doing it, and they've realized some benefits out of it. There are a lot of enterprises who have shut down data centers and have actually moved to the cloud. So there's no question. Where I believe the work still entails that, you know, we in IBM used to call it chapter two, you know, a few years ago, which really is that thing is about, okay, now I'm beyond that lift and shift model. I'm kind of into core systems, modernization, replacement, et cetera, et cetera. That journey that impacts core applications and a true business process transformation, that I think is where there's still a combination of, I'm going to say, traditional, classic, legacy technology and, you know, new technology all mixing together, right? And there is definitely a shift in terms of going towards this cloud model, but it's a very, very difficult exercise, right? I mean, you know, modernizing is not for the faint of heart, right? So it does take, you know, quite an effort to do because it's less about technology, as we always know, in a lot of these transformations. It's really these organizational and operating models and culture and skills and other things that come into play. And the politics thereof too, right? Because, you know, when you talk about business process transformation and changing application ownership or changing applications, now you got like three or four different yellow bees and teams and trifectas all coming together and having to resolve amongst themselves. And that takes time, right? So they, all these things really, you know, are the ones I think are behind probably the slower adoption that people like us, we predicted probably, you know, certain things would happen faster. But what we're finding out in reality is that it's a very, very difficult process. You know, we kind of anticipated that to some extent, but I don't think many of us probably didn't have the extent of how difficult it was going to be as we went through this stuff, right? So it's as much a human change as it is a technology change, right? So, yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, you mentioned DevSecOps, and to me, those two things are very closely related because one of the things the cloud gives you, it gives you the ability to put more power in the hands of the developer. I mean, obviously, that's often the desired effect then. Time to market, right? Faster, you know, coming out with evolutions of your applications and so forth, which then, you know, creates this tension between more traditional operational roles, for example, and the developer roles. And I think that's still there.
That is still there. There's no question. I think it's on both ends, right? I think developers are realizing slow on. I mean, you know, some of us used to talk about this fact that you don't want to be the developer that gets a call at 3 a.m. in the morning, right? Because they never used to get a call at 3 a.m. in the morning. That's the classic developer model, right? So it's a someone else's problem. Now, when you are the person that actually gets a call, your attitude changes, right? But now the problem with that is they now take the other extreme to say, it's all mine and I don't have to worry about. So the entire production control is mine. So I make decisions. And that's not true either because, you know, you are dealing in an organization where the CISO has policies and they have to govern you. You have operations, you know, who have to govern how you do certain things, et cetera, et cetera. So you still have to work in a model where these things can come to life with developers having actually control. So it's about, my analogy is rights and responsibilities, right? Duties and rights. So yeah, you have a right to make decisions, but you have a duty to kind of do it in the right way, right? You know, keep into consideration. So I think that's the, you know, cultural change that developers have to go through as this dev and ops kind of come together a little bit more.
You mentioned earlier that you're doing solutioning kind of over the years, you know, basically picking up what is state of the art, right? And you mentioned service oriented and, you know, now cloud in all its facets. Where do you see this go next? And where I'm leading with my question is, how quickly do you pick up and adopt new things that are coming out? And then maybe even a comment on something like, obviously, what's in all the news right now is this, these large language models, generative AI and so forth. How long does it typically take? And this is obviously a brand new thing, and there's a lot of hype around it right now. There's also a lot of skepticism. So in the real world, which, if I may say so, which is where you live and like getting things to actually work in mission critical ways, how long will it take for these things to kind of trickle down where they become relevant to you, or are they relevant to you already today?
Yeah, it's a great, great, great question. And I think we have to parse it a little bit, right? So starting with the simplest way to think about it, you know, to your last point about how relevant it already is relevant, but, and there's always a big but to it, right? So, and that's when the step back comes into play. So in general, leaving generative AI aside for a second, right? I mean, that's a current inflection point that we're dealing with, obviously. In general, you know, when we do systems building and systems engineering, there's always this notion of what is the technology that has to be adopted, and by the way, how is it effective, et cetera, right? So that question is always there. And typically, you know, as architects, we go through, you know, I'm going to say three broad inflection points, right? One is, you know, around what we typically call the horizons. The horizon three technology, which is kind of out there, that's emerging just a bit now, you don't want to adopt immediately. You don't want to experiment with it. You definitely need to encourage experimentation. You need to encourage incubation. You need to encourage learnings and experiential gathering. So you know what it is and how to work with it. So you got to encourage innovation like crazy, right? But the key word there is innovation and experimentation, right? Not immediately at scale. So I think the Horizon 3 technologies definitely need that kind of embracing to say, yes, it's solutioning, but is there a space I can actually employ it in that is not necessarily mission critical, where I can play around with it without having, you know, while it learns, but don't impact day-to-day, you know, business, so to speak, right? In a negative way. So I think we got to leave room for that. As technologies emerge and we do have the proof point, you again get into what we typically call Horizon 2, which is, yes, it's proven. Now it's time to start maturing it, right? So that's really where the serious adoption actually starts, which means I had to build capability. I had to kind of start scaling it. I had to start standardizing it. I have to create patterns out of it, et cetera, right? All these things, you know, start emanating out of it. And then it gets to Horizon 1. Now it's fully mature. It's at scale. Now you can optimize the heck out of it. And actually now it's a mainstream for you. Now, this being a typical technology curve for anything in general, now the tension starts, right? Systems builders, you know, really want proven things, you know, which means they want to start with the Horizon 1 before they go to Horizon 3. Whereas experimenters and innovators want to start with Horizon 3 and kind of push the heck out of it. So as architects, you know, we have to kind of figure out the balance and pros and cons of what making the right choices. For instance, to say, I do want to experiment. I do want to make sure that I take the learnings from some of these new things. And maybe if I find something of value, let me actually put it in the solution. But make sure that I do it in a way where I'm limiting a blast radius of negative impact. So that's kind of how I want to deal with that. So in general, that is the approach that we take in solutioning, you know, to your point. Speaking specifically generative AI, yeah, you're right. I mean, this is literally, I don't know, I don't think 9 out of 10 of us were speaking about ChatGPT or generative AI May of this year, May of 2022. I don't think it was, you know, this big a discussion, right? In the general mainstream circles. But here we are in May of 2023, and literally, you know, you can't wake up in the morning without dreaming about generative AI, because, you know, that's when we are. And in that said, I think everyone is, when I say everyone, I'm talking literally everybody. There is not a single enterprise that I deal with or a single CIO or a CTO that I'm talking to who is not asking me this question or, you know, in general interested in how that is actually getting used.
There's probably a lot of peer pressure or perceived peer pressure.
Everyone
else seems to be doing it. We need to do it, you know?
And I think that's part of the hype. That's unfortunately the, you know, where a lot of this is actually also, right? Because you got both of them. That's a reality to it. Because I actually was telling, we were on a call this morning and we were talking about this specific topic exactly. And I've been playing around with the paid version of ChatGPT for the last 4 months. And it's incredible, the uncanny ways you can actually get some of these answers while, you apply your sense to say, I kind of know some of this already. I'm just testing it. But it's really amazing how much it's grown. And my view is, even if it is not mature today, the exponential growth on how quickly it's going to mature and how quickly it's going to, become better, I think that's what we need to watch out for, right? So, for example, if you're building a system and you are architecting a system that's going to take you about, 16, 15 to 20 months to go realize, understand that what you're visioning today that goes into production 2 years from now, your landscape has fully changed. The capability of generative AI at that time is way better compared to where it is today. So you have to think about, where you're going to start applying ahead of time, and you can start experimenting now so you can realize it in production 2 years from now, right? So that thinking has to come into play. And the other thinking that we, I usually, again, go back to my 2x2. One is generative AI from the standpoint of, your customer experience, right? So, we know about the Masters app in the recent incarnation of it and how amazing it has been received in the recent Masters thing, right? Whether it's AI-driven commentary or whether it's a whole-by-whole analysis and so on and so forth, it is incredible, how the customer experience actually got changed. So there are two, real-life implications and use cases of value you can actually create out of generative AI even today. There's no question. And the other dimension of it is how generative AI is changing the way we create these things. So how did the Masters app actually get created? The software engineering process behind it, right? The life cycle behind it. How do we go re-engineer that? We know about, what is the co-pilot from GitHub, right? That's already there. Pair programming, do I need a second pair programmer or do I need co-pilot that I can actually use with, right? And by the way, how trustworthy is that, right? That's true. So there are aspects of software engineering that are already changing. If I take my favorite problem child in the entire space of root cause analysis in a complex environment when things go haywire, how difficult root cause analysis is, in that when a production issue occurs and people are scrambling to figure out exactly what actually occurred, I can bring up the service and restore service now, but I'm really trying to debug the service to exactly why it didn't happen. And in a complex environment that's in a distributed computing model where service providers everywhere, the handshakes are very different and models and maturity is different, RCA is a very, very difficult problem. So applying generative AI in that kind of a context to accelerate the process to become get it more accurate, not just agility, but also accuracy, right? Those are areas of a great opportunity, right? I fully anticipate in about, a 12 to 24 month period, these kinds of areas are going to have dramatic impact, right, in terms of how quickly and well they're going to be. So yes, there is value to it. There's no question. I don't think we can shy away from it. We have to be careful, as you mentioned. But I think there's a great value in that kind of an emerging technology. And we have to go through that model I talked about, experiment, mature, and then scale, right? That's how you need to think about it.
And by the way, a challenge with all of this that I think, well, it pops up here and there is that these models are extremely large and complex, and you need enormous computing power to have them, to use them, to train them, to consume them even. And the fear is that it's actually eventually going to be in the hand of a few players who can afford it. And that might, to some degree stifle the innovation that you can create around all this because it's not a very accessible space, so to speak.
Yeah, but I think even that is changing, right? To some extent. In fact, I was, I came across this discussion, not on Discord, but outside of it. Even the model training is actually getting democratized through the open source community quite a bit. So what is, to your point, what is in the realms today of the OpenAI and the Microsofts and the Googles and even IBMs of the world, right? In terms of large enterprises large amounts of investment and capital that goes into it to go do that, to your point about in the hands of a few, I think that's also going to rapidly change because the open source movement is already got onto it. I think Meta, in a kind of one of their work actually got leaked maybe a couple of months ago. That is now the open source community discovered it and they actually improved upon it dramatically, right? In about a matter of space that not a single company can ever do. So I have a feeling that as this again matures, the open community is going to come into play and they're going to democratize the hell out of this, right? So in that sense, it's going to go a little bit lower, that doesn't take away the expertise that's required. That's just spot on. I think this is not for the faint of heart again. I think it's going to require some dramatic expertise to be able to do this right. And even the, in a sense, it's also a pendulum, right? What used to be a narrower field of AI has now become much more, you know, horizontal and foundational. But I think as that evolves, we are going to get back into the space of, let's get industry-oriented models, for example, right? Or domain-oriented models that are a bit more. So I think we're going to go through the pendulum swing a little bit too. So that's kind of where I'm thinking this will go.
So we're slowly running out of time here, but there's one other topic I'd like to hear your opinion on. That is in the same category of like big buzzword, a lot of hype and excitement. I wonder like how and when you think that's going to apply to, again, the real world, so to speak, and that's quantum. Where I work in security, so for us, where quantum becomes relevant is in quantum safe.
Safe, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's we see that as an entry point into this whole space of quantum computing, not necessarily using a quantum computer for some of your core business function, but looking at it from the element of how do I need to encrypt my sensitive data to make it safe from being decrypted by a quantum computer. Right? So what's your point of view on all this?
The one thing I know for sure is whatever we say today is probably going to change dramatically. So, because, you know, I'll tell you, I, not just me, I think several of us who have been incorrect in how quickly AI was going to advance, yeah, in the last like 10 years. So back in 2010, if you had asked me a similar question around AI and how quickly, you know, it's going to become relevant, you know, I would have predicted, you know, somewhere in the, you know, like 2025 to 2030 timeframe, it'll take that much time span for it to get to where it was in 2015. So I think, you know, that advancement there has been tremendous. So I'm going to use the same analogy on quantum to be able to say, on one hand, yeah, you're spot on that I think the your bigger concern today is around quantum safe and the ability of the keys to be decrypted, you know, when quantum actually comes into fore, and we need to protect against it, right? So that's definitely a concern, you know, for a lot of the enterprises, and that's the right way to think about it. But with that said, most of the mainstream application, because I don't know if it's going to displace traditional computing. I think it's going to complement traditional computing in that sense, at least for the next, you know, foreseeable future, right? And for that, by that I mean like the next 5 to 10 years. Beyond that, all bets are off. I have no idea. Yeah, honestly. But in the next 5 to 10 years, I think it's going to complement it. And the complementary feature is going to be in some of these, and definitely quantum safe, but also some of the specialized industry use cases that we always talk about, you know, whether it's in, you know, gene discovery and DNA processing, et cetera, all that stuff, right, that we typically talk about. But with that said, you know, this is a space I think, you know, we are still grappling with, right? I think the mainstream community, I don't think is at abreast with quantum as much as it does with generative AI, for example. The quantum is still out there for most of us. Generative AI, you know, real or otherwise, it's here today, right? That we have to deal with.
All right. Like I said, we're out of time. A final question to you, if I may, is,
yes,
I've said a lot of my guests, is if you could give us an example of something really exciting and cool that you're working on right now. Doesn't even need to be an IBM, could be outside of IBM in your personal time, to the degree that you could share, but something that gets you excited when you come to work every day.
It's interesting you asked that. I would have never put my finger around it. I think generative AI, to some extent, helps me put the finger around it in a different way. But about 4 years ago, you know, I was starting to think about this problem of, we're just spending a lot of time writing software, quality software, that actually performs well. For as structured engineering is, and as structured bits and bytes are, this is one of the most insane pieces of work that we as humans actually do, which is spend so much time writing shitty pieces of code. And I always felt like this is an area where if I had to envision DevOps in future, I know we talk about no ops. I truly believe it is actually it's not no code, low code in that sense, but really is about how we're able to generate software and we're able to measure software development through the process in the, not the idealistic world, but pretty pragmatically, you know, highly automated, right? So this is where it was, and I believe now we have a tool at our disposal that I didn't even envision, say, 3-4 years ago. So this probably is my area of passion, where, you know, I am, because I deal in the real world, as you say, you know, I'm always frustrated by how difficult it is for software engineering to produce the outcomes that we always think it needs to produce, right? So that to me is probably the eternal problem that we are going to chase after.
Even though I have to admit, you know, I've been in software engineering for decades now, and I don't know if the term case rings a bell, you know, computer aided software engineering.
Yes.
So I even feel like in the 90s, I was told like, yeah, the need to write program that to actually write code is going to go away very soon because we're just going to have tools that will do it for us, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And here we are 30 years later and we're still looking at it. So
exactly. Yeah, I have two, I always give people two anecdotes about technology, right? The power of technology and the caution of technology. We used to talk about paperless society and lights out data center back in the 80s and 90s, if you remember, right? Guess what? One of them is pretty true. The other one, never, right? I mean, you know, look at that. I still deal with paper right now. So the human brain needs to write, you know, it needs to think, it needs to have a different way. So paperless society is an interesting concept, but data, you know, lights out data center, that we achieved, you know, quite a bit. So both are interesting promises as we think about them. So in that sense, yeah. You know, we'll have to determine if truly automated software engineering, not for automation, for not for automation's sake, but really to achieve the velocity and quality outcomes we talked about. That outcome, you know, is that going to be a paperless society example or is it going to be a lights out data center example? You know, only time will tell.
Okay. I like that analogy. That's an interesting way to look at it. That's it for today. Thanks a lot for all that insight. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely, Andre. My pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Well, with that, we're going to wrap up today's episode. Thank you all for listening and hope to see you all soon again. Bye-bye.